side, because it's, you know, there's no movement. It doesn't really matter. History will be the judge. If they want to force me into exile, fine. You know, I'm not going to be miserable. I will make as positive an impact of the world as I can from the situation that I can. About the case with Julian and the assassination plans against him, the rendition plans against him, it's really an extraordinary story. You are listening, you haven't read this, you absolutely should. You know, the CIA was planning out the White House and their partners in London having gunfights in the streets of London. If, you know, they had to shoot out the tires of a plane, who was going to do that? Which service was going to do it? Just absolutely, you know, it's crazy. It's hard to believe, or it should be hard to believe. But unfortunately, in the direction that our society is progressing in the post 9/11 period, is becoming more familiar. And I think that's uniquely threatening. It's funny. When I came forward in 2013 in Citizen Film, I think there's a comment in the film where I'm like, you know, the embassy's right up the street. They could rendition me, or the triads, or whatever. You know, just try to off me. Whether they do it to hands-on or whether they say, oops, it was an accident, he fell. To me, those things were possible. And at the time, even journalists who were working with me, Barton Gellman, Washington Post at the time, said he thought that was, you know, a little bit ridiculous. But years later, as he began to see he himself was subjected to surveillance, he saw that the U.S. intelligence services had been keeping tabs on his reporting before he was ever involved with me. And of course, now we see things like Julian. Force is not a barrier to the state when it comes to securing their objectives. And I believe anything they could have done to stop this story, they would have done if they believed it did it. If that meant taking action against me, if that meant taking action against a journalist, I believe they would have done it. In the case of Julian Assange, that thinking has been vindicated. Julian Assange is not a whistleblower. That's not a judgment on him. That's the fact that he's not the source. He's the publisher. That means he should be less at risk than the whistleblowers. And yet somehow he has ended up more at risk. Now, the question is, how is that possible? Has Assange changed? And we look at what the charges against him are. Not really. Talking about things that happened in the distant past. What has changed is the nature of the state and its relationship to the press. And if we let that be established with them murdering Assange, not with a gunshot in the streets of London, not with a drone, but with concrete in Belmarsh or Florence or whatever prison they put him in, that is not better. Whether you kill someone fast or you kill someone slow, if you are killing them because you don't like what they say, that is, I think, a final judgment on the state. Rather than on the victim of the state.
That's National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden, along with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Glenn Greenwald and Chris Hedges. I spoke to them as part of our discussion at the virtual War on Terror Film Festival. We'll link to our entire discussion at democracynow.org. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
Welcome, everybody. I have to start with some really crazy things today. The first thing is the next kind of chapter in the martyrdom and lionization of Kyle Rittenhouse. Now, I'm not going to retell you the entire Kyle Rittenhouse story, but Kyle Rittenhouse was 17 years old when he went to Kenosha, Wisconsin with a firearm, and he killed two people, shot a third, claimed self-defense, and was acquitted, found not guilty. As I said, that based on how these laws are written, that not guilty verdict is not really the issue here. It's Kyle's presence there being emblematic of so many of the things wrong with the country, gun culture, education, parenting, etc. And one of the concerns we knew it was going to happen was that Kyle Rittenhouse was going to be made a hero. He got an interview with Tucker Carlson with a hero's welcome. He got to meet Trump, etc. This is now taking on an even more insane tone. There is a new series about Kyle Rittenhouse produced with Tucker Carlson hosting and narrating. It's on Fox Nation. Fox Nation is a Fox News kind of like offshoot that includes rehabilitating the program Cops. So it kind of gives you a sense of the type of content that they produce. And it's like a bizarre reality show made to make him look like a complete and total hero. So check out just like a little clip of this and just the entire vibe. It's all completely insane. Look at this.
Kyle Rittenhouse.
Oh, Kyle Rittenhouse. It Tucker, is so nice to meet
it's
you.
It's really good to meet you.
I can't believe you're
Big
here.
Fan of your show.
Well, we're fans of yours, as you know.
Yeah.
Yep, that's me. You're probably wondering how I ended up in this situation.
For most Americans, Kyle Rittenhouse is more meme than man. But in real life, Rittenhouse is a working class kid from the least privileged sector of our society.
So, yeah. As I've said, first of all, who's the audience for this, right? That's one thing to think about. Like, we're watching it as a goof and because it's so absurd. And because it's a media story that there is a media outlet doing this, but there are people who watch this seriously and they go, wow, what a hero. What a great kid. He did a great thing. And remember, he didn't do a great thing. He was somewhere he shouldn't have been with a gun he shouldn't have had. And he caused a situation in which he feared for his life. I would concede he plausibly feared for his life. And he was acquitted, but we don't celebrate it. We say, wow, this was a tragedy. It should have been avoided altogether. The lesson wouldn't be he's a hero. The lesson would be would have made sense never to go in the first place. But this show makes him a hero. Then, and this is just wacky, Tucker Carlson in a direct-to-camera sort of thing explains that he basically uses kind of like Bolshevik style revolution as an analogy to the desire for the imposition of anarcho tyranny in the United States and links all of this back to Kyle Rittenhouse. Take a look at this.
Tyranny. You may have heard the term. Here's the most straightforward definition. It means anarchy for the people in charge, tyranny for the population. Anarcho-tyranny is a system in which pedophiles and career criminals are released from prison by the state to terrorize the law-abiding. If the law-abiding defend themselves, they're prosecuted by the state for murder, smeared by the media as terrorists.
Arguably a domestic terrorist.
All as corporate-sponsored activist groups burn their country to the ground. We're seeing this, but we've seen it before. In the years before the Bolshevik Revolution, Russia was deeply destabilized by crime and chaos, and that set the stage for the Bolshevik takeover. In the Soviet Union during the Great Terror, political dissidents were put on trial for daring to defend themselves against criminals. In the Soviet Union, you could only use a knife in self-defense after you'd been stabbed. Does that sound familiar? The trial of Kyle Rittenhouse may be the first anarcho-tyrannical show trial in the United States. It may not be the last.
So the most curious part about that is the analysis is a completely bogus analysis. It's flaccid in every way. It's pathetic. It's a wet noodle. But do you think the audience of this network and of this show that's watching it in a serious way knows about Bolshevism or anarcho-tyranny? I mean, seriously, like even it, this is a perfect example of, you know, people, you ask them, do you read history? They go, yeah, I read Bill O'Reilly's history books. Like, okay, who is the audience here? And it's all wacky and it's meant specifically to inspire a certain type of person to accept without questioning what Tucker is telling you. And of course, accept that Kyle Rittenhouse is a hero. Truly just bizarre stuff. Here's a clip from the end. And in this scene, they put Kyle Rittenhouse, like it's so overproduced. They have Kyle Rittenhouse wearing a suit on a beach. And Tucker celebrates that Kyle Rittenhouse is moving to Florida, which is a free state, and also frames Rittenhouse as a victim who now is going to have to deal with all this for the rest of his life.
Kyle Rittenhouse wanted to move to the paradise of Florida, to the free state. Now he has his chance. Even so, he will never have the luxury of living a normal life. He'll never be able to erase the slander and stigma laid on him by the media and by his prosecution. Those are the consequences of the trial of Kyle. The next time, it could be you.
I like how Tucker says, you could be next. You know, one way to avoid being the next Kyle Rittenhouse is don't go to locations of unrest with firearms. Then you're not going to be the next Kyle Rittenhouse. Now, of course, Tucker would say, well, no, there's a million other ways in which you could be victimized by the system the way he was. But what an overproduced sham. And my prediction is that this show will do really well with the Fox Nation audience. So this is, we said they would make him a hero. They're making him a hero. They're making him a martyr. They're making him a sage. And it is completely and totally disgusting, but we knew it would happen. We've talked for a while now about how the Republican Party has essentially abandoned policy, like in some vague way, taxes are bad and, you know, regulation is bad. But even since early in the Trump administration, after the tax bill passed, the Republican Party stopped being about policy, but rather about cultural issues. I am going to show you now a fundraising email sent out by Donald Trump's Save America PAC, which has the closest thing to a policy platform on it. Trump lists a bunch of stuff, almost like we would list, well, we want to make sure everybody has access to healthcare. We want to make sure that you're not going to be killed by pollution and that emitters of pollution are regulated. And we want to make sure that people are paying the right amount of taxes to properly fund social services. And here are the social policy, right? Trump sends out a fundraising email that looks like a policy list, but it's crazy. Look at this. Trump, you know, Trump's not writing this, but it's being sent down under Trump's name. Friend, have you noticed that the radical left is now admitting I was right about everything they lied about before the election? And here's the list. Hydroxychloroquine works. Now, hydroxychloroquine is a medication that works for some things. No evidence it works for COVID. The China virus came from a Chinese lab. That's not been demonstrated. Hunter Biden's laptop was real. Well, it was a real laptop, or it was really Hunter's, or it really contained the things you claim. Again, this is the, like, it's like a policy platform of crazy. Lafayette Square was not cleared for a photo op. In fact, we know that it was. The Russian bounties stories was fake. It appears to have been real. We did produce vaccines before the end of 2020 in record time. Okay, I mean, you know, that's one where it's sort of what is being implied. The mRNA platform allows rapid vaccine production. So when Trump says, without me, it would have taken 10 or 12 years. No, without mRNA, it might have taken seven or eight years. You had nothing to do with mRNA, and that's why the vaccine was produced quickly. Blue state lockdowns didn't work. You know, what's interesting about that is they sort of did, actually. Like, early, we had the situation where the COVID cases and deaths were disproportionately happening in blue urban centers, because those were the places with the major airports flying back and forth to China and Europe, where the virus was brought to the United States from. Once vaccines became widely available, the case rate and the death rates in red states, and in particular in Trump counties, way, way, way higher than in Biden County. So that's wrong too. Schools should be reopened. They basically are open. Because of Omicron, now a few colleges have said we're going back to remote, but basically schools are open. Critical race theory is a disaster for our schools and our country, and our southern border security program was unprecedentedly successful. This is so funny because it's sort of like a stupid person's policy platform. It looks like policy. There's really no policy. Like, hydroxychloroquine works. It's a statement of fact. It happens to be incomplete. It works, but not for COVID. But what's the policy behind it? And this seems to be, to some degree, a reaction to realizing that we've got to have something we're kind of running on to get people to give us money, but we're going to make it really what is, at the end of the day, cultural stuff. And the saddest thing about it is the Glenn Youngkin victory in Virginia shows us that this type of thing works. He ran against critical race theory in Virginia, which was not even being taught in Virginia schools, and he won. Terry McAuliffe made mistakes as well. So this may be the closest we get to a platform from Republicans. It's a joke, but sadly, it might work. And that's why we've got to really be ready for 2022. Part of getting ready is we are going to try to resuscitate declining membership numbers. On January 1st, we'll be doing a one-day membership special. It's going to be huge. And if you'd like to be notified, just get on our mailing list by signing up at davidpakman.com. January 1st, you'll get a beautiful email from me telling you exactly how to sign up. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this. The program that you are listening to right now or watching right now, The David Pakman Show, is primarily funded by viewers and listeners who sign up on my website and get a yearly or monthly membership. These memberships come with very powerful benefits, including a daily extra show, as well as access to commercial-free audio and video streams of the shows, and so many other great things. Sign up at joinpakman.com. We are going to hear from some folks in the audience. We take calls now via Discord at davidpakman.com/Discord. It's great to hear what is on people's minds. Why don't we start today with Chris from Texas? Chris from Texas, what's going on?
Hey, David, this is Chris from Texas. How are you doing? I mean, never mind about that.
I'm doing well, thank you.
I guess one thing I'm wondering is that, like, with Biden, I know some people are wanting Bernie to run again, but I don't agree with that because of the fact that, like, I love Bernie with all my heart, but I feel that with Bernie, after losing twice, I think it's just going to make him look bad, and I think it'll hurt the progressive movement overall for him to run again, just because it'll make us look as if we are not willing to cooperate with the Democrats.
I don't think it's about cooperation at all, but I agree with you. I think that as a combination of Bernie's failed runs so far, as well as Bernie's age, some people might be furious with me, but I think the window of opportunity for Bernie has closed. First and foremost, if Joe Biden runs again, Bernie's not going to beat him in a primary. So that already makes us look at 2028. And yeah. I just don't see it. I think it's unrealistic. If somebody wants to change my mind, you can try, but I just don't see it.
Yeah, I guess I'm just also worried also about the future as well. Like with Biden's approval ratings going down, I kind of want him to do other things, like maybe do another UBI and potentially also doing something like along the lines of like maybe being more forgiving on the student loan debt.
Wait a second. Hold on. When you say do another UBI, do you mean a COVID stimulus check?
I mean, that's probably on my least worries, but I feel like I'd be more willing for him to do something along the lines of like maybe extending student loan forgiveness canceling off at least $10,000 of student loan debt.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I agree with those things. I want him to do those things. I never believed that those were things Joe Biden was going to do when he was running, and he seems to have no interest in doing them. I just don't think he's going to do them. Now, should we pressure? Of course. I mean, this is what activism is for, but I don't think he ever had any interest in doing those things. But I think the point we're maybe kind of converging on is the left needs some kind of the progressive left needs a charismatic leader within the Democratic Party. I don't think it's Bernie. Is it AOC? I don't know. I think it's too early to say, but I do think that a charismatic leader is needed in the progressive left.
I do feel like AOC would be a good candidate, but I feel like one problem that she has is that she's only been her highest level of state of being elected is only the House of Representatives. I feel like she would either need to at least maybe challenge someone like, what's her name again, Gillibrand or Hochul for a state level position.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, I mean, that there will be time to look at that, but it sounds like you and I are mostly on the same page.
One last question I have, though, too. I guess, considering I'm kind of a little scared about the Republicans potentially getting back the Senate and House in 2022.
Yeah.
Why hasn't Joe Biden or any of the Democrats with their power right now tried to admit D.C. and Puerto Rico as states? And so we can at least give us some way of a buffer from preventing the Republicans from gaining more seats.
Again, I love the idea. Joe Biden doesn't seem interested. It just doesn't seem a priority. Now, remember, you know, D.C. would almost certainly be two Democratic senators. Puerto Rico is a little bit more of a question mark. Puerto Rico is more conservative than some people think. On balance, it would still be great for the Democratic Party, but Biden just doesn't seem interested in that.
Yeah, but we would get at least around seven seats in Congress, at least.
That sounds about right. Yeah, that sounds about right. I would love to see it. I think they should be states. I don't believe it will happen before 2024.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the call, David.
All right. My
nice
pleasure.
Talking with you again.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate hearing from you. Good questions. Specific good questions. Let's go next to Jason from Huntsville, Alabama. What's happening in Alabama these days?
I still don't understand how anyone. Sorry.
Jason from Alabama, you're on the air, and it sounds like you're on another call there.
Yeah, I moved to Huntsville when I first started. Okay.
Listening to some kind of show. Jason, did you want to talk to me, or are you just watching TV? I don't know.
This just went on and on.
All right, well, that's too bad. Let's go next to Nick from Long Island. Nick from Long Island, you are on the air.
So I wanted to ask you, since Democrats aren't really caring about getting anything done right now, like lowering prescription drug prices because of the roadblocks that we face in the Senate, and the fact that Biden can try to use pressure politics, do you think Democrats actually care about winning in 2022 since like they're not like getting anything done?
So I don't know that I would characterize the situation the way you're characterizing it. I mean, to speak specifically about prescription drugs, Build Back Better actually has a bunch of prescription drug stuff in it, including limiting out-of-pocket insulin costs through insurance to $35 a month, which is major just in and of itself, given the number of people with diabetes in the United States. I agree with you, generally speaking, that the Democrats are not getting enough done, and there needs to be some other major policy accomplishment to be able to point to in order to justify people voting for Democrats in 2022. And on whether Democrats care about winning in 2022, I do think there are some Democrats who have been given the numbers and they've been shown, here's what's going on with redistricting, here's what's going on with this. We're going to lose the House in 2022. And some may have given up. I disagree with that position. But I don't know that it's that they don't care. I think I just see all of the situation a little bit differently than you.
Yeah, well, you know, another big issue that I hear a lot on like shows like TYT, they talk about how, you know, they say legalized bribery has something to do with not getting popular provisions done. And it just seems to me like corporations really want Democrats to lose elections because it would make sense because Republicans would easily just grant them more tax cuts. Don't you think so?
It's not as cut and dry. There are lots of large corporations that understand that the economic policies of Democrats are more demand side stimulus rather than trickle down supply side stuff. And they know that those things are good for them. Many corporations realize if everybody makes a little more money, we now have customers. with a little bit more money, which they can spend here. Like, that's a demand side stimulus economic idea. And the truth is, for most corporations, they're not really, most corporations are not political in the sense of the corporation is liberal or conservative. They're trying to do what's best for them. And often it's hedging their bets by donating to both sides. I mean, that's the sick reality of it. You look at cable, ISPs and cable companies, you look at big food. Most of these companies are donating some to both sides so that they can have friends in power no matter who wins.
Yeah, I think that pretty much answers my questions.
All right, Nick from Long Island, thanks very much. Appreciate the call. Let's go next to Cody from San Diego. Cody, I'm going to be in San Diego this weekend, in fact. How's the weather looking?
Hey, David, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Cody.
It's just got done raining down here, but it's looking pretty good today.
All right, good. Well, yeah, I'm hoping to have a nice sunny weekend.
Yeah. My question was, first one, I was just, I keep hearing like all these people on the, obviously on the right, but a lot of people on the left have like a problem with AOC and her policies and just, I guess, her personality and everything. I was just wondering what your opinion was and what you feel about her, what you think about her. I generally tend to agree with her and like a lot of what she does. So
yeah, I think AOC is extremely skilled politically in terms of her ability to communicate, in terms of her ability to participate in congressional hearings and question people. I think she gets a lot of issues right. As I've said before, I think she lacks some knowledge when it comes to certain economic ideas and on some foreign policy stuff, but she's still relatively new. We would expect anybody to lack knowledge in some areas. It's not like a big deal. You know, it's not like a big attack on AOC. So I think she has major potential to be a huge player for decades in the progressive movement if she wants to. And at the same time, she may not want to. She may want to do this for a little bit and then do something completely different. So I think in terms of thinking about the future of the progressive movement, we don't want to put all our eggs in any one basket, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Just a real, I guess my other question would be, I heard a lot, it was in the past, there was an article that came out and Destiny talked about it a little bit, that people were talking about how much voter suppression actually affects elections. So I recognize that like it's probably kind of a combination of like voter suppression and redistricting tactics that kind of cumulative affect elections. But in your opinion, realistically, how much do you think like voter suppression tactics actually affect elections?
This is such a hard thing to answer because the first thing is which elections, right? Which elections? Are we talking about a presidential race? Are we talking about congressional districts for the House of Representatives? I'm not asking you to give me the answers. I'm just saying in order to really answer the question, we first need to define that. Then there are aspects of this that can be measured and aspects that are tougher to measure. So for example, if someone is rejected from voting because of a specific rule, we could say, wow, that's definitely someone whose vote was affected by voter suppression. But if there are people who, because of their awareness of voting has been limited in this way or voting places or whatever the case may be, say, I'm not even going to look at voting this year, that's sort of like soft voter suppression. And I don't trust that we can accurately quantify that in any real way. So my answer is, in sum total, there is no doubt that voter suppression tactics combined with gerrymandering have an effect. How many races are won or lost on that basis? It's a very difficult question to answer. But here's a really important thing. The fact that it's a difficult question to answer doesn't mean that we should fall for, well, then it must be having no effect. That would be fallacious to go to that.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Well, that's the questions I had. Thank you so much for answering.
Thank you for calling. Great to hear from you. Why don't we go next to Terry from Fresno? Terry, you are on the air.
Hey, David, how's it going?
It's going well. Thank you.
So I wanted to ask about the idea of optics in intra-political issues, because it seems like optics don't really matter across like party lines, but insofar as like Democrat on Democrat, like what's the purpose of arguing optics in something when that's clearly not what's happening?
I don't know what you mean. So give me an example of an argument Democrats have with each other about optics. What's an example?
Like the optics of AOC going to the Met Gala wearing a dress that says tax the rich.
Okay.
Like there have been arguments about like, oh, it's not a good look for somebody who is fighting for income inequality, who is going to like the Met Gala where a bunch of rich people are.
I see. And then there was the counterpoint, which was like, no, it's great that she was there because she was she was something different instead of just celebrities and whatever. And that's exactly where like that debate you're talking about.
Yeah. Things of that nature, because like ultimately I think it obscures like actual issues.
I tend to agree with you. So for me, that debate was not interesting. For me, the optics debate that's more interesting is actually one that's between Republicans and Democrats. And I'll give you an example and tell me if you think this is more relevant and interesting. We've talked about hypocrisy in politics before, and we've talked about how, take foreign policy. First, Republicans said it's patriotic to go to war when it was the Iraq War. And then with Obama was unpatriotic because he wasn't willing to start wars and he was going to leave the country open to attacks. But then when it was Donald Trump, the patriotic thing again was he won't get us into wars, but Hillary will. And then now with Joe Biden, it's why is Joe Biden giving Russia warnings? So they're totally hypocritical, right? The problem is the right doesn't care about their own hypocrisy, while the left does seem to care about hypocrisy. That's really interesting to me because it raises questions of should the left also stop caring about hypocrisy and double standards? Or how do you take advantage of the hypocrisy of the right if their voters don't care about the hypocrisy? For me, that's like an optics debate that's much more relevant and substantive.
Yeah, I can understand that. Although I would say from my perspective, you can't win a basketball game if your opponents have guns and are shooting people.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like you have to play the same game that everybody else is playing. So like to me, the optics conversation insofar as like they don't care about hypocrisy, but we do, that conversation, it just stops because like if you're not willing to play the same game, then you're already losing. You know what I mean?
I agree. And this gets to a lot of our discussions about without committing crimes or doing straight up immoral things, Democrats have to recognize that we have to use the system we have to try to win, or otherwise the system will just get worse.
Yeah. And I'm not wholly against, and granted, I'm very much so on the political extreme. Like I am for a long time, I was like one of those people who was all about the spirit of the game, right? Like you play basketball, right?
Yeah.
So when you go play basketball, you respect the foul. If somebody calls a foul, you're playing a pickup game, you just respect the call.
Sure.
You don't argue it. You don't do all that. But like if you're playing against people who argue calls and will just shave points off and do all sorts of stuff, then what's the point in playing the game if you're not going to do the same thing?
Right. I guess the question is, yes, exactly. Unless the problem becomes when things are more life or death than basketball and you end up with really bad options of having to degrade yourself maybe, or just let them be the only players, which is also terrible. You got some tough decisions to make.
You absolutely degrade yourself in every instance. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
If the choice is like letting a bunch of your constituents maybe lose the right to have abortions and like maybe playing a little bit unfair or doing the same things that Republicans do, then I feel like the option every time is do what's best for your constituents.
Right. Right, right, right. All right. Very important issues. I appreciate you bringing them to me today.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a very quick break. We are going to keep taking calls right after this short break. So if you are holding, don't hang up. We're going right back to the phones. All right, let's go back to the phone lines and hear from a few more people. We don't really use the phone lines anymore. We use Discord, which you can find at davidpakman.com/discord. That is the place to find it and chat with me. Let's go to Tyler from Columbia. Is that Columbia, South Carolina? Tyler from Columbia, you're on the air.
Hey, David. Sorry, it's Tyler from Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, Columbus, Ohio. Got it. You're on the air.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm a longtime listener, a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
I guess my first question is, I don't really think, given the polling trajectory with, you know, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, I think we would almost assuredly lose if we run either of them in 2024. I think Biden's going to be too old to run. I don't think he's going to seek re-election. And I think, you know, Kamala Harris is not a good choice. So who do you think, if it were up to you, who would you pick to be the Democratic nominee in 2024?
I have no answer, because at this point, there is really nobody in the Democratic Party that I'm genuinely excited about. And that I see. And when I say excited, I mean, not only do I like them on policy, but that I also believe that they are sort of like a political superstar of sorts. You know, there was something, like him or hate him, there was something about Bill Clinton when he entered the national scene where it was like, this guy is a political superstar, different than you agree with him on every policy or anything like that. But it was just, he had a certain something. Barack Obama has a certain something. I don't think Joe Biden really has it, but I think the circumstances still allowed him to win. And I am with you. I think that particularly if Trump is the nominee, but even if it's someone like Ron DeSantis, who seems right, you know, looking now, seems like the other possible guy. I don't know that Biden wins re-election. And I think if he steps back and there's sort of a coronation for Kamala Harris and she's kind of just handed the nomination, I don't think she beats Trump or DeSantis. So I am extremely concerned. What I'm trying to do, though, is say, let's get through the midterms first, because what happens in the midterms is going to really determine the context in which 2024 takes place. But I am as worried as you are right now.
Do you think there is a scenario in which Democrats hold the House?
I think it's possible, but unlikely. I think we have to fight for it, right? I don't know what number I would attach to it. I would maybe call it 10 or 15%, but that's high. The stakes are so big that you've got to fight. If you've got a 10% shot, you got to fight for that.
I agree. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much for the call. Very much appreciate it. Yeah, I'm not trying to be unnecessarily pessimistic. I'm just kind of explaining it the way I see it. You know, let's go next to Jeff from Dallas, Texas. Jeff, you're on the air. Wow. Literally, yes. Sounds like water.
Hi, David, can you hear me?
You're not actually underwater, are you?
No, I was running.
Oh, my God. Okay. What's going on?
Oh, sorry. I mean, I was trying to get away. Okay. Yes. So first off, love the show. It's my first time calling in, so I'm just very excited to be able to chat with you.
Thank you.
So sorry if I'm going to sound a little nervous, because I've never done this before.
No, you're doing great.
Okay. So I kind of want to, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the...
All right. Unfortunately, Jeff, your service is so bad, we can't hear you. You're going in and out. So we will have to try to make the connection at some point in the future. Let's go next to Noah from New Jersey. Noah, you are on the air. Noah, hey. From New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hey, can you hear me, David?
Yes, I can.
Cool. So I don't know if this is a good question to ask. It's not maybe as informational. I kind of have a two-part question, I guess. I still live at home with my parents, and they're both Republicans. My dad has the vaccine, is considering not getting the booster shot. I just got my booster shot.
Okay.
And my mom is completely closed off to the idea of getting the vaccine. So I just wanted to see if you had any insight on sort of how to deal with sort of family interactions when that's sort of the dynamic.
Well, why doesn't she want the vaccine?
She's not quite on the level of QAnon, but she's kind of, you know, a little bit paranoid and definitely has some misinformation misleading her.
Okay, like what does she believe about it?
I honestly, to be honest, I don't even really know. I know she doesn't really believe that there's like, I don't think she believes the whole tracking device thing, but I think that she just doesn't think it works, maybe. She doesn't think it's necessary. Yesterday she said that my niece has a cold, and I said, is it definitely a cold or is it COVID? And she said, well, it's definitely a cold because kids get colds all the time. And I was like, well, yeah,
it's not really an argument. So here's the thing.
Right.
First, you've got to figure out what it actually is, because you said a few different things. You said you don't think she believes the tracking chip stuff. She may not believe the vaccine works, or she may not believe that the vaccine is necessary. These are all different things. So my process would be, and obviously you have to decide for yourself how much you want to argue about this with your mom, but my process would be, first, really figure out by listening why they don't want the vaccine. Only when you understand that can we even go to the next step. The next step would be figure out what would change their mind. So if they say, well, the reason I don't want it is I don't think it's safe, you would say, well, if your personal doctor told you it was safe, would you take it? Yeah, I trust my personal doctor. Great. Try to get her to talk to her personal doctor. Other people might say, well, I don't believe that it's effective. Then you say, well, if I showed you what... if who said it was effective, would you change your mind? And maybe she says, well, I don't know, if you showed me data or whatever. The point here is, first, you've really got to understand why she doesn't want it. Right now, it doesn't seem like you understand that well enough to really move on to step two.
Right. Okay. And do I have time to ask one other quick question?
About yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
So I, you know, I've spent time following people that maybe, you know, used to be in my life that are hardcore Republicans, simply for the fact of sort of entertainment. Stuff that they would post would be entertaining to me.
Sure.
So I was I ended up unfollowing most of those people because I just felt like it was actually ended up being draining to myself, and I didn't think it was healthy. So I just wanted kind of wondered if you feel that being so involved in politics and having to keep yourself updated with it so much, if that sort of drains you mentally.
Yeah. And so I have to do this for work. So on right. my Facebook, I have unfollowed certain people like that I went to high school with that completely lost their minds. Like there's this one woman who I went to high school with, who graduated with me at the start. I knew she was sort of a Republican. And before the pandemic, she would post some gun stuff and some religious stuff. At the pandemic, she started posting every insane link to every conspiracy theory, vaccine stuff, Fauci, Bill Gates, microchips, everything. So I just unfollowed, you know, because it's just overload. If I'm just browsing Facebook and keeping up with what my friends are doing, I just don't need to be seeing that. I do think the consideration's different. Like I work in this field. So like when I'm looking at Twitter, which I use for work, I can't just get rid of all of the crazy right-wing stuff because I'm reporting on it, I'm covering it, I'm engaging with it. But yeah, it is draining. And another thing I recommend is take days off, entire days off. I don't follow what's going on the weekends barely at all. Like I'll see my mom on a Sunday morning and she'll be like, did you see? And I'll be like, I didn't see it. I checked out after finishing the Friday show. So I think scheduled time away from it is really important.
Right. All right. Thanks, David. Thanks for taking my call.
All right. My pleasure. Very good questions there. I like it. We had a couple dropped calls today, but the ones that we got were really, really good. Why don't we go next to let's try Marcus from Manitoba, Canada. Marcus, you're on the air.
Hi, David.
Hi. Please make sure that your Discord doesn't bling. We've already heard one bling and it's very distracting to everybody.
How do I turn off the blings? I'm sorry. I'm
you got to turn off your notifications in your settings. Just turn all sound notifications off. But you can go right into your question.
Okay. I've been waiting for a long time to do this. I've been passed over every time. But anyways, going straight into the question. Something that I've noticed, a sort of concerning development that's really sort of been taking place, I guess you could say, across the democratic world, but I think especially notably in America, is this, I think this growing tendency to view democracy, well, this growing cynicism about democracy, this this kind of view of democracy as a sort of purely instrumental device, right, for the as simply sort of a means to the end of enacting whatever policies, whatever ideology a particular side wants to enact. And I think this is a very dangerous development. I don't know about you, but I was wondering, like, what is your view of democracy? Do you think that democracy is something that is inherently valuable, that is something to be valued in itself, whether or not your side is the one that is benefited by it? Or
right.
Do you think that it is something that is sort of merely instrumental value, that it's only valuable if it enacts policies that we that we like? That
I gotcha. I don't have either view. My view is not that democracy is valuable regardless of the outcomes or regardless of, in other, I don't believe that democracy is valuable for its own sake only. And I don't think that democracy is valuable only as an instrument that allows my side to win. I think that there's an in-between view, which is we can have a number of different systems, and there could be a system that is a good system even if my side doesn't always win. And that's generally speaking my view on democracy. I don't think democracy is valuable for its own sake. I think that democracy has a lot of problems. You go to, you know, read Socrates on democracy, and, you know, a lot of fair criticisms of democracy. And we talk about many of them. A lot of incompetent people get to participate just like others who are informed. Outcomes are sometimes bad. It can be, system can be corrupted, et cetera. So I don't think it's valuable for its own sake. At the same time, even when my side loses, it doesn't make me think we need a dictatorship or we need authoritarianism or whatever. I do think that on its merits, it's the best system we've come up with so far, but that doesn't mean it's the only good system. I'm open to another system being better. So it's, I have an in-between view on that issue.
Okay. I mean, I think that's a very reasonable perspective. It's something that I've noticed among, like, obviously it's very blatant on the right, both in the US and in various other countries, that, like, you know, they're not even really pretending to care about democracy anymore, or they're pretending, but in just such a transparently cynical way.
Yes, where, absolutely. I mean,
if
hello. Okay. All right, I guess he's gone. Good question. Interesting topic. That's going to do it for calls today. We'll talk to everybody again very soon. Sorry I wasn't able to hear from everybody today. All right, let's get into emails for the week. Remember, you can email info@davidpakman.com. If you have something to say, please use the email address sparingly, because if you use it a lot, your emails will get auto-flagged into the trash, unfortunately. I was actually, we were updating our system the other day. And we actually have close to 100 different people that email us so much that their emails are just being auto-filtered. So don't be one of those folks. Send an occasional message if you have something to say. First one actually comes from Facebook and says, could you be any more delusional? You constantly spew propaganda and claims that are easily proven false. Then you never retract. You're a pathetic joke. I have to congratulate this person. It seems almost like a legal requirement that if you send right-wing hate mail, you mix up your and the contraction for you are, YOU'RE. This person actually got the right your here, and they really should be commended for that. Now, everything else they say is, of course, untrue. They don't cite anything that I was wrong about or correct me. They're also wrong that we never retract. In fact, when I'm made aware that we got something wrong on the show, I will usually open the following show and actually just say, hey, I got something wrong yesterday, and here's what it was. I apologize. Here's what it is. Okay, next one from Chris. Chris says, vaccine hesitancy in other countries. David, sir, I've recently read there is vaccine hesitancy in other parts of the world. I realize that in America, most of the hesitancy is politically based. What is your opinion of this phenomenon in other countries? Love your show. Listen daily. Paid subscriber. Keep up the great work. It's different in different countries. We've talked about vaccine hesitancy, for example, in France versus in Italy and in other countries as well. In some places, it is political, as influenced by what's going on in the United States. So there are other countries where folks have been convinced by the rantings of American right-wingers about it's authoritarian, it's oppressive, all of this different stuff, and they've just sort of gone with that. There's also a pretty sizable anti-big pharma sentiment in some other countries that drives vaccine hesitancy. And, you know, in the United States, we talked about this with Nicholas Christakis 2 weeks ago. Before the COVID vaccines in the United States, you had anti-vax on the left and you also had it on the right. The left-wing anti-vax tended to be motivated by distrust of big pharma. I don't trust big corporations. The anti-vax on the right tended to be dominated by I don't trust the government, meaning if a school requires my kid to be vaccinated, I don't trust that, or whatever the case may be. And so you had a kind of crossover of anti-vax from left and right. In the United States, COVID anti-vax is overwhelmingly right-wing. It still exists on the left. Jordan Klepper recently did some interesting interviews with some folks in at the LA area, and they don't seem particularly right-wing. They seem more distrustful of vaccines along the sort of like Reiki, homeopathy, herbs type thing, which is more of a left-wing thing. And you see that more in other countries as well. You see that in Italy. You see that in France as well. So the answer to what drives anti-vax in other countries is it depends on which country. And there's a little bit of everything floating around. A next email came from PP, who says, "Hey, David, I was wondering if you could shed some light on this new Fauci Bill Gates email thread that Alex Jones and Glenn Beck are saying is a smoking gun, that COVID was a product of gain-of-function research, and then them, along with Moderna, had the vaccine created 6 months before the virus came out and released it on purpose, and all kind of wacky stuff." Yeah, I can't comment. Unfortunately, I can't shed any light into that. That sounds like five or six different conspiracy theories blended together into a smoothie of sorts. And I have no idea how they all come together. I've never even heard of them put together into one conspiracy like that. One thing I think is important to consider is if the conspiracy is so confusing that you can't even really come up with plausible motive linking all of these groups together. Like, as I've said many times before, finding motive alone does not prove a conspiracy theory. But if you can't even find motive or understand it or even really understand what the theory is, be skeptical of the people that are telling you that this is the way that things are. Austin wrote in about Trump's weird sniff and says, "David, I haven't heard you bring this up yet, but another one of Trump's big tells is that sniff thing he does after almost every sentence. Very annoying and a pretty good indicator he's spinning another yarn. Keep it up, bud." I've never seen the Trump sniffing as a signal that he's lying, because he sniffs almost all the time. Now, you might say, "Well, yeah, but David, he's lying almost all the time." But even when he says inconsequential things, I see the sniff more of like as a tick, or maybe something related to medication he takes or something like that. And it is notable. He'll say, I got home and Melania said to me, "Sir, you were on TV." And then there's the sniff there. For me, it's less about lying. It just seems to be a verbal thing that Trump does, maybe related to medication, but it never seems specifically like a lie signal. The big lie signals I've identified are he claims someone called him sir, like when the infamous story, the one that's the obvious lie, when he said, "When I came into office, a general came to me and said, 'Sir, we have no ammunition. We're out of bullets from Obama.' And I told him, 'Well, let's buy more.'" Like, that story couldn't have happened. That's a lie. The other one is he says, "And it's really a shame." He'll say, "Well, 100,000 dead people voted, And they took Michigan and Pennsylvania and Arizona from me. And it's really a shame. It's really a shame. That's a sign that he's lying. And then the other one is, and it should never happen again, or we can't let it happen again. They took the election with an insurrection on November 3rd, and we can't let it happen again. He's lying when he uses that one, and also many, many others. But the sniff one for me, that's a different category. Leslie wrote in with a non-political question. This is actually a really good question. Leslie says, "Hey, David, love the show. Would appreciate your input. If a group of people go on vacation together, would you split the cost of the vacation rental per person or per bedroom? I've always subscribed to per person, but I've discovered recently a friend uses the per bedroom calculation. When divided per bedroom, the single friend pays more for their room than the couple. In my mind, all other parts of the rental home and its amenities would be considered equal. So why not the bedrooms? In your opinion, which is correct?" You could really go either way with this. You know, if when, let's imagine not a vacation rental, but let's imagine an apartment, right? Because at a vacation rental, you don't usually pay for electricity, water, utilities, etc. If you're renting an apartment and you've got a couple sharing a room and then a single person sharing a room, it seems reasonable to me that you would say, okay, in terms of space, we have a room and you have a room. So that would be split equally, even though it's two people versus one. But you would adjust for the fact that utilities are going to be higher for the two people. And how I do that, how you do that, I don't know. You say, well, we will pay, I guess you just say if the utilities are paid separately, we'll pay 2/3 of the utilities, but half of the rent. That seems reasonable mathematically. On a vacation, I think I would take a totally different approach, quite frankly. And it's who proposes it, and honestly, who makes more money? You know, there's a lot of situations I've been in where it's sort of like if someone is financially better off and says, "I'm the one renting, I'm renting this house either way. Come on and, you know, throw me $100 or, you know, whatever the case may be." That's often the way it actually goes, less than on a per person or per bedroom basis. But as a general thing, on a vacation rental, I lean heavily on per bedroom. Per bedroom. Let me know what you think. Evan wrote in and says, "Conservative hypocrisy about natural immunity. David, sir, I see many conservatives and vaccine skeptics espousing the use of monoclonal antibodies to treat COVID, such as Dennis Prager or your more recent segment on Joe Rogan supporting it. This seems very counterintuitive to their baseless theory that so-called natural immunity is better than vaccine immunity. Is it not hypocritical that they are so against a vaccine that will strengthen the immune system against COVID, but are willing to take a different drug that also strengthens your immune system against COVID? I understand the drugs and their effects are different, but from their perspective of so-called natural immunity, they are still unnatural substances you're putting into your body to fight off the virus." Of course, yeah. Monoclonal antibodies. I mean, listen, when they say they don't trust the vaccine, but they trust the antibodies, the Pfizer vaccine is now fully approved, whereas the antibodies are only approved via emergency use. So it's a lower standard. Number two, when they say, "I don't trust Big Pharma," the monoclonal antibodies are also made by Big Pharma, and they are far more profitable at, I think, about $2,000 per treatment than, you know, a $15 to $30 vaccine. So the money argument also doesn't make sense. And yes, in a sense, you are generating immunity, not simply by fighting off the virus, but via the integration of other antibodies that you didn't create into your body. So it is absolutely hypocritical along those lines as well. Very, very good point. And what's the answer? The answer is they don't actually care. They're just against the vaccine, because all the arguments they make against it fall apart when you see that they're doing monoclonal antibodies or other big pharma treatments or things that are not actually FDA approved either. James wrote in and says, "Congressman Nunes was on the evening edit on Fox, and my jaw practically dropped. They were complaining about Hunter Biden making money with China, and how he shouldn't be allowed to fly on Air Force One, and he was trading with the enemy. These are the same people that had no problem with the Kushners making hundreds of millions of dollars while working in the White House, and Ivanka being granted trademarks by the Chinese government. My advice on this Hunter Biden stuff is, do not even engage. Just ignore it. Like, I don't really know what they're saying now about Hunter. I know some right wingers write to me and say, David, you should be talking about Hunter. Hunter has no involvement with the Biden administration. And of course, all of the criticisms of Hunter apply, maybe not all, but close to all of the criticisms of Hunter apply certainly to Jared and Ivanka at minimum, if not also to Don Jr. and Eric Trump. They don't apply to Barron, I guess. That would be the exception. And Tiffany, everybody forgets about Tiffany. Yeah, just I wouldn't even pay attention, quite frankly. Zach from Orlando has a crazy story and says, just wanted to share a story I overheard while at the office yesterday. For context, I work in Orlando and occasionally have to visit the corporate office in Tampa. When I arrived, I overheard our COO and CFO complaining about the traffic on I-4 and how it's all part of Biden's America. You see, David, according to these highly overpaid executives, ever since Biden got into office, nobody wants to work. Since nobody wants to work, there's less truck drivers on the road. That would be fewer. Since there's fewer truck drivers on the road, trucking companies have to hire people with less experience, although I thought nobody wanted to work. And finally, since there are more inexperienced truck drivers on the road, there's more traffic. Ah, because by virtue of being less experienced, they drive more slowly, I guess. Makes sense, right? Couldn't possibly have anything to do with our crumbling infrastructure, poor public transit options, etc. Nope, all Biden's fault. Yeah, that's pretty full on. I mean, that's wackier. It's so specific, and it's sort of a problem. How do I even say it? It's an explanation in search of a problem, sort of. I don't even know how to say it fully. But that's really wacky. And Zach, I'm really sorry that you're working around that kind of nonsense. Hopefully it's not like that every day. Thanks for all of your emails. You can send yours to info@davidpakman.com. And we've got a great bonus show planned for you today. You can sign up at joinpakman.com. And
Grant and I and the rest of the Away With Words team have been sending out this podcast for 14 years now. And we still have so much more to talk about. We're just getting started. Your questions and stories are what keep this show going. We could never do it without you. We learned so much from you, and we're so grateful. We also depend on your financial support. Go to waywardradio.org/donate and help out the nonprofit that produces this show. Here's to lots more learning and laughter.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. I'm always glad to learn a new word that I didn't know I needed. And Grant, I learned one from you the other day that I really appreciated.
Was it a four-letter word, a naughty word?
No, it wasn't one of those this time.
Oh, I think I know the one. It was because a friend of ours had an accident.
Yeah, a friend of ours unfortunately got knocked over by a big dog at the dog park. And you told me there's a word for that. I had no idea.
Dogberg.
Dogberg. Yeah, to get knocked over by an animal is to be dogberged. Apparently, it comes from the name of Bill Goldberg, a professional wrestler who had sort of a signature move where he would just do what they called a spear, like just run at somebody and knock them over, I guess.
Yeah, so the word is Dogberg after his last name. And he's a massive man, just built like a mountain, and he kind of gets this look on his face. You can find videos on YouTube where he kind of lurks in the corner of the ring, and he does like a spear move at his opponent who, you know, because they've set it up so the opponent is kind of oblivious, and just dives at this guy and just his opponent and whips him off his feet.
I am so glad to have a word for that. I've been wanting a big dog myself. You know, we have a little one, but we wanted a big one as well. But now I have a word for what I fear. You know, as much as I love big dogs.
Yeah, dogberg, because they are single-minded in pursuit of a squirrel or a gopher or whatever it is that they're after. And they ball, frisbee. They often don't see what's between them and their target.
Yeah, they're wonderful, but being dogberg is not a good thing. Well, obviously, we talk about all different kinds of language on this show, and we'd love to talk with you. So give us a call, 877-929-9673, or send us an email. The address is words@waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, my name is Cheryl. I'm from Fort Worth, Texas. And my boyfriend are curious about what it means when you say, I'm going to suss it out. We're going to suss this out.
Ooh, what was happening that you needed to suss things out?
Well, so he learned this from a friend he was working with on a radio show, and they, anytime they would have to figure something out, that her, his friend would say, well, we need to suss this out.
Certainly can't go wrong with starting a show off with some surf music. Zombo right here in your brain. WRCT Pittsburgh. And yes, this is the fourth week of my best of the year. And I'm already going to tell you right now, it's going to extend in the next week. Next week is gonna, just January. It's going to extend the first week in January with leftovers. Okay. So what I did is it's a quarterly report. I managed to play the best music I could find, the best music that came my way the whole year of 2021. And I started at the beginning of December, you know, the first 3 months, second 3 months. Right? So this is the last quarter. This is the last 3 months. So it's stuff that I've just recently got. And then next week is going to be all the leftovers. So it's going to be still some really great music, but I couldn't squeeze it all in the 4 weeks. We're going to go on to five. So that was Surf Noir was the beginning. That's what this was. And it was the West Samoa Surfer League. And that was from their album Surf Noir from 2019. Actually, it was a mini album. But now I got to tell you, sometimes you'll get a record or I'll get a record. And it's just like, it really renews your faith in new music. You'll hear something that's like, wow, that is a new record. It is beautiful. It just kind of makes you tingle and it makes you feel good and it makes you feel like the world's a pretty decent place and it kind of gives you some kind of hope. Yeah, and it does happen. You do get that. What's a good word for not being able to express it? That kind of feeling. All right. And that is exactly up with this next record that came out by Wesley Stace. And if you haven't heard the name Wesley Stace before, that's actually the real name of John Wesley Harding. And he came out with some really nice, kind of almost like a cross between Elvis Costello, Bob Dylan, and Leonard Cohen. Really, really nice stuff. Here Comes the Groom was a fun record. And actually, he was on my radio show in Akron about 20-some-odd years ago. and a really interesting guy. So that's the thing. I got this record, Wesley Stace. I didn't know